Call the Commerce Committee to order. You notice some chairs have been saying the dates and everything. It's March 2nd. It's 12:08 and a half. Central Daylight Savings Time. Whatever.
One more week.
One more week.
Then what do you say?
We have two, three, four things we're going to be talking about today. The first one we're going to visit with is Senator Kent on the Motor Vehicle Insurance Coverage Verification Task Force report. We want to hear about this. And
can you give me their information?
There's a first time out has been taken.
Thank you. Feeling like we should move on.
Okay, welcome Senator Kent and Ms. McCormick from the Department of Public Safety is here with you. And Senator, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Commerce Committee. We are pleased to be here today to talk about the Motor Vehicle Insurance Coverage Verification Task Force. That really flows right off the tongue, as we've all learned over the past several months. It was a really great experience. I was pleased to get involved in this initially as a part of the Insurance Reform Working Group. Senator Jensen had asked me to participate in that working group because of my involvement on the Transportation and Public Safety Committee to bring in the public safety element into the working group. And pretty quickly, we ran across the topic of uninsured motorists and how that fits into the overall conversation. And it's a little tangential, but, you know, it was something that kept coming up, and we thought we should spend some additional time on it. As a result, and you're getting a copy of the PowerPoint, so we'll just get through that. But as a result of those discussions and the work of the working group, we established a task force in last session that would review and evaluate approaches to insurance coverage verification and recommend legislation to create and fund a program in this state. And so it seemed like we have some time. There's been changing technology. This was a good time to sort of revisit this issue in the state of Minnesota and see if what we're doing works well or if there are things we can do that would work better. So from July 2014 until February of this year, the 15-member Motor Vehicle Insurance Coverage Verification Task Force met multiple times to assess our processes and the issues related to insurance verification. And I'm pleased to say that we have a number of the members of the task force in here with us. I see Joel Carlson. Obviously, Senator Gazelka was a part of the task force. Christine Zimmer, I saw, is here. I'm going to forget. Bob Johnson was an honorary member. He wasn't officially on it, but he was there all the time and observed all the discussions.
On behalf of the committee, I want to thank the task force for all the time and effort you put into this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And DPS did a great job of running the task force and in help with the Department of Administration. So as we got into it, we did expand the scope to include what was should have been intuitive, but we wanted to be very explicit about it, to include the question of how could we, can we, should we reduce the rate of uninsured motorists in the state of Minnesota. So first, to sort of set the stage, just look at where we are right now. One of the things that we learned quickly within this topic is it seems pretty straightforward and simplistic, but when you get into it, there are a lot of complexities that exist. So it's always important to start with understanding where we are before we can figure out how best we could try to move forward someplace else. So currently, Minnesota law does require drivers to possess proof of insurance at all times and to maintain insurance when a vehicle is operated or when its use is contemplated. Data can be challenging, and we'll talk some more about that, but the things we think we know about uninsured motorists in Minnesota, that there has been a decline from 15% in 93 to 13% in 2009 to a current number of 10.8%. I know that when we were, and a lot of the times those numbers can be cyclical, potentially with economic swings. Again, not a lot of data to explain some of these fluctuations, but that is one that is sort of understood. So that the 10.8% number is comes from the Insurance Research Council, and you know, there are questions about whether that's precisely the right number, but it is a useful number because it is the methodology is used across all states so that you can look and compare states on a consistent basis. And it's the same methodology that's used over time, so the trends would be consistent over time. So it does definitely have value there. But it was interesting because I know in the course of the working group, sometimes people would say, well, we think there might be as many as 20% of Minnesota drivers are uninsured. That's a big number, one in five. 10.8%, that puts us lower than the national average, and, you know, it helps sort of target where we are and what potentially we think we could do in terms of solutions. And it's worth noting that does compare to the 12.5% number nationally. There's a really charming chart right here that I'm not going to take you through, but it shows you basically a flow chart of how the current proof of insurance and verification process works. For example, when you're doing registration or title transfer is one scenario. Then you have when people come across law enforcement, either because there's a crash or a traffic stop, that kind of thing, and what happens if people don't have their proof of insurance on them and the situations that flow out of that. And so basically, currently, under current law, it is required that motorists attest to having insurance coverage when they do title transfer and vehicle registration. Law enforcement requires proof of insurance at traffic stops, and if the person can't present proof at the time, it must be shown to DVS in the courts at a later date, and that's all prescribed through law. Penalties for failure to produce proof of insurance include a fine and potential revocation of driver's license and vehicle registration. So that's the current situation. Right now, it is a manual process with DPS and the Driver and Vehicle Services Division. Recent trends suggest that there are new technologies. We know that. We're learning that from a lot of other states that provide an opportunity to improve the verification process. And currently, over 30 states do use an electronic verification process. This electronic verification process, or EVP, allows users to verify their insurance information based on the data on proof of insurance cards and show that the coverage is current. There are three types of EVP. You can use a book of business download to create a database to verify the insurance. You can use an online verification service that allows users to direct the inquiry to an insurer's computer. Or there are hybrid versions of those two systems. And many states are adopting different versions of these, and the jury's a little still out on that. There are not direct correlations that exist in states.
Back up a second here, and maybe Ms. McCormick or somebody can. This electronic verification that we're not doing here in Minnesota, it seems to me that we put millions into this over the years, or am I in the wrong area where the state has invested in this electronic monitoring and put millions into this area. And Ms. McCormick, am I right or wrong on that? Where did all that money go, and why are we still needing to pour millions into this thing?
Chair and members of the
committee, give me the dope.
For the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. I think you're talking about our MinLiars system, which is a redesign of our motor vehicle and our driver license mainframe system that we have right now. So there is a project that's ongoing that is working on that, but it does not have anything to do with electronic verification of insurance.
Why not? Could it work in there somewhere? Have we put 30, 40 million into this area?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's I think it was 36 million that was the price that and it's collected as an extra fee on transactions. But that was to design the motor vehicle and driver license system, because we have a system that's a mainframe system and it isn't able to do does not have the advanced and enhanced technology that we need to do transactions today. In terms of motor vehicle insurance, we have a system where you just attest to the fact that you have insurance when you either are registering your vehicle on an annual basis, or if you're doing a title transfer, you would attest to the fact that you have motor vehicle insurance. But that is the process that we currently have.
So $46 million doesn't get us to a lot of stuff, I guess.
Okay. It was $36 million,
$36,
Mr.
Whatever
Chair.
Okay. Yeah, so. Yeah, it's, we've been talking about this, it seems like, for 15 years, and we're still not there. So.
And Mr. Chair, this, as you can imagine, was a big subject of discussion in the task force because we would need Minlars to be online before we can effectively consider adding any of these electronic verification programs that exist out there. We simply could not do that now with the mainframe system we have currently in place. And so the question is, you know, we started at looking at the question, should Minnesota consider moving into that type of system? And as you will see when we get to the recommendations, the answer is not yet. But we can go more into the detail. But it is an important distinction to understand that what Minlars is doing would be a critical foundation if we wanted to go to an electronic verification option. I hope that's clear. This all gets in the weeds pretty fast. So that really sort of sets up the background. And then the task force, it was, I thought, really satisfying to observe the task force really work through all of these issues. We looked at a number of states and the approaches that they're taking and the relative costs and benefits of those different approaches. You know, people often want to say, and I've heard from constituents and others about this, it's like, well, we should just insist everybody have insurance and make sure they have it. And it's like, that sounds just great, except that it's a little more complicated than that. And that's what the task force really spent a lot of time and energy and very thoughtful in considering all these different intricacies as they went through the process and understanding what we have, what other options exist, and how we can move forward. So with that, I would turn the rest of the presentation of findings and alternatives and recommendations over to Ms. McCormick.
Okay, well, welcome, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So before that, Senator Kosoka.
And I apologize if this was asked, but so if it's asked twice, it means it's super important. But I think back in 2005, we talked about insurance verification on there. Can you give us a date when Minlars can actually do insurance verification? I mean, I'd rather not wait another 10 years. And so I would like to hear a prediction or at least an educated guess from you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to ask Dawn Olson, who's our Minlars project director, to come to the table so that she can talk about that.
Good afternoon. My name is Dawn Olson, and I'm the Minlars program director at the Department of Public Safety. Our plan right now is that the motor vehicle functionality will be delivered by October of 2016, and then we will immediately move. We're planning for driver services requirements in next year, but that the functionality for driver services side would be delivered by early of 2018.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we don't want to have the same discussion 15 years from now either. So I think that's what Senator Kitsuk and I are talking about. Go ahead, Ms. McCurry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the findings that the task force came up with, first of all, is that data is limited, that there's a lack of reliable and up-to-date data related to the uninsured motorist rates, to the characteristics of uninsured drivers, and to the cost and effectiveness of the various options for verifying insurance or for reducing uninsured motorists. There's, for one thing, the uninsured motorist ratings differ between the various states based on the type of program that's operated. But in terms of how it's calculated, it's the ratio of uninsured motorist claim frequency to the bodily injury claim frequency. And there's no correlation between an electronic verification program and the uninsured motorist. And as Senator Kent said before, right now Minnesota is at 10.8% in terms of uninsured motorists. There's many factors that affect the uninsured motorist rate. The state's ability to reduce uninsured motorist rates depends on whether there's whether there's effectiveness of a particular approach or a verification for reducing the uninsured motorists. Other factors can include the socioeconomic factors, public awareness of insurance requirements, enforcement of insurance requirements, as well as the state's verification policy. No verification system would be completely accurate or lead to 100% of compliance was one thing that the task force understood after a long review of various programs throughout the country. The timing is critical for electronic verification program, and we believe that it would not be fruitful for us to even consider it until after the MNLAR system is in place and implemented. Electronic verification programs can lead to false negatives due to policy number and vehicle identification number errors, and there are times where the electronic verification programs need time for additional study towards effectiveness. And so as a result, we need the technology to evolve. And a lot of states have tried it unsuccessfully and have gone back to other methods of using for verification of uninsured motorists. Minnesota's uninsured motorist rate has declined from previous years. It's lower than the national rate, I think, as Senator Kent said, of 12.5%. There has been a fluctuation in our motorist rate, but there's no data that really supports why there's been this cycle. And that's one of the things that we found to be the case, not just in our state, but across the country, that the trends change. And it, some of the factors, as I said before, are economic factors that in terms of what people can afford in terms of insurance. Claim payments for accidents caused by uninsured motorists has decreased along with the insured driver's cost of that claim payment. And so some of the alternatives that we've considered were making a second driving without insurance offense a gross misdemeanor, increasing fines for second offenses, and reducing the number of uninsured motorist violations that are waived. The role of the courts makes some of these options feasible because that's a separate branch of government. Not recommended for right now is the electronic verification process, as we talked about, because of the required resources. And while several options appeared to be easy solutions, when we got into further investigating them, we determined that they weren't desirable for the state or determined they weren't feasible. And an example of that was DWI-style plates for vehicles of insurance violators. The task force recommends that we have a comprehensive approach to address the uninsured motorist problem. And that approach does include a possible implementation of an electronic verification system. But the task force recommended a four-step approach to the uninsured motorist problem, and the electronic verification would be the fifth step. So the first recommendation is that DPS should strengthen its proof of insurance requirements. The task force recommends that in all DVS transactions, we require three additional pieces of information as proof of insurance: the insurance company name, the policy number, and the expiration date. Right now, people attest to the coverage at vehicle registration and vehicle renewal. If registration cannot be renewed without this information, it creates an incentive for people to buy insurance. It also increases the awareness that motor vehicle insurance is required by law and prepares people for the potential of an electronic verification program that would require proof of insurance at registration as well. And this would also require redesign of a DVS registration renewal form, as well as some statutory changes, because, as I said previously, the current law allows us to have vehicle owners attest to the fact that they have insurance at the time of registration. The second recommendation is that the state should increase penalties for people who are convicted of driving without insurance or without proof of insurance. The task force recommends that the Judicial Council be asked to consider removing no insurance and no proof of insurance offenses from the statewide payables list in order to require insurance violators to go to court. Fines could be more than triple if the maximum fine were assigned by a judge. Currently, a person may mail
Excuse
in
me, Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Ms. McCormick, can you give us a clear sense of why or how increasing the penalties for individuals who are convicted of driving without insurance would help in any shape, form, or fashion? Just to put it in context, right now it's my understanding if a person gets stopped by the police and they don't have their insurance card because maybe the insurance card was coming in the mail, maybe something's happened, but they don't have it physically with them. They will receive a citation, from my understanding, and then they are given, up to 10 days to turn in that information and show, in fact, that they've had insurance. So can you help me understand how this new policy would impact that the current process and tie in whether that would decrease the number of uninsured motorists driving on our roads?
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, I think the issue that a lot of the task force members discussed was experiences where people may purchase insurance for that day to be able to say that they have insurance, and they also can pay that and say they have insurance and put the fine in and send the money to the court through the payable list. They don't have to necessarily go before the judge. And so then people may have insurance for a brief period of time to do that, but then they cancel their insurance so that they don't have to continue to make the payments. And that seemed to be not just the experience that we talk about in Minnesota, but when talking with other states that we had conversations with Ohio and several other states in the nation, that's an experience that is true in other states as well.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Champion.
Then if that, thank you, Mr. Chair. If that's true, but isn't there both a criminal side of to this question and then also a license side to the question? So if this citation is on the payable list and a person keeps paying it, then that impacts whether they can maintain their driver's license or not. So can you help? Well, first of all, verify if what I'm saying is true. And if what I'm saying is true, then how is it just increasing fines on one side of the equation is really going to get to the ultimate question, which is to make sure that people are insured?
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, I think what I'm talking about are when we talk about this particular one especially, we're talking more about insurance violators who don't have proof of insurance at the time they're stopped for possibly a speeding violation. There are other requirements in the law that would require proof of insurance if there was some more serious violations that might occur. And in those particular cases, you may have to go to court. We're talking about the people that are, in this particular case, would be speeding and would be considered a suspension of your driver's license or a possible revocation. But if it's a serious offense, then you would go to court, and I think there would be extending violations, and there would be a much larger fine than in cases of speeding violations.
Senator Kosoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Champion, I was on that working group, and one of the things that we acknowledged was that if the fine is dramatically less than what it would take to buy insurance, then why buy insurance and why not just take a chance that you know, you weren't going to get caught, and then if you get caught, you pay a fine, but the fine's less than you would have paid anyway. And so that was, I think, the main thing we were talking about here. We were also very careful. We looked at other potential penalties. Gross misdemeanors was something that somebody recommended, and a number of us thought that was too far, you know, that we didn't want that kind of penalty for folks like this. But we certainly don't want them to feel like it's worth it just to take the risk, and when you get caught, pay the small fee.
And Mr. Chair, to follow up on what Senator Gazelka is saying, a lot of the conversation was sensitive to the fact that somebody may just not have their insurance that day or something could have happened. A lot of the emphasis was exactly as Senator Gazelka is describing. People are making a personal economic cost-benefit analysis, saying, is it worth it to pay for insurance coverage on an ongoing basis, which is the law. That is the thing that is required by law to do, or to say, I'm going to take my chances. So what the task force was trying to do was figure out, is there a way that we can stiffen penalties on repeat offenders for people who are doing this as a matter of practice and not catch people who, you know, for a particular circumstances might have a bad day or a bad week.
Okay, continue on.
Mr. Chair and members, the other thing I would want to mention is that there is, we did have the representatives from the court also appeared at the task force, and they expressed the fact that the reason the Judicial Council has this approach is because it would mean an additional number of judges that would be needed. I think it was a seven judges that would be needed to be able to handle the volume, as well as they said that it would cost the courts $2.45 million a year in order to implement this without the payables list. So we just wanted to make sure that we provided that information to you as well. The next recommendation is the state should implement a public awareness program to support new processes and promote compliance with the compulsory insurance law. This would minimize the disruption to the public with an introduction of the additional proof requirements at registration and emphasize the penalties, including the fines and the license suspensions. So the goal there would be to educate the public about the new proof of insurance requirements at registration renewal and focus on the consequences to remind people that it's illegal to drive without insurance. So a public information campaign would require the participation of multiple entities, and we believe that it should be across multiple entities. Recommendation four was that an ongoing committee or advisory council should be created to help implement the task force recommendations. This would assist the state in developing effective policies, establish goals, direct the activities, and also, which would be important, to measure and analyze the data, including the effectiveness of an electronic verification program, which is used in other states, and the effect of Minnesota's policy changes. So the recommendation was that it could be a subgroup of an existing legislative committee or an independent group that would be similar to the task force. Because there's little data on uninsured motorists, this would help ensure that data is collected and decisions are made about the future direction for the task force, and that it be data-driven. And the fifth recommendation is the state should reassess the electronic verification program's expected benefits, its costs, and the implementation issues. After MNLARS is deployed and operational, this would be the time that it could be evaluated, and results would be known of the stronger proof of insurance requirements. The electronic verification program has evolved in a lot of other states, and there's a lot to be learned, and we believe that would also give us time to see how those programs, many of which have just been in operation for a few years, how they are operating and whether they are really effective in improving insurance verification.
Yeah, there's a bill. Or in transportation.
So those are the major recommendations that the task force has made, and we'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
And, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I can just make one sort of wrap-up comment. When we look at that 10.8% number, it's called 11% to round it, you know, and the question is, how do we reduce that? How do we get that smaller? Like, I know from my experience working in marketing and working with populations, the closer you get to 100%, the harder it is, right? So the challenge is, you know, let's start with the low-hanging fruit, what is easiest and least expensive to try to impact, and we think that's what we're doing here, you know. And then the question becomes, what do we do to chip away at the remaining percentage points? Part of our challenge is, as Ms. McCormick mentioned, the data on uninsured motorists in terms of sort of specifics and understanding who they are and why they're not insured is really limited. And you can imagine a number of scenarios where people are driving without licenses or without insurance for different, you know, if you don't have a license, you can't get insurance. And without knowledge and understanding about who those people are and why they're not insured, it's hard to make targeted, successful recommendations on how to solve that problem, how to fix that aspect of the issue. So, and this is a national problem, and we, you know, we found some data that was 20 years old, and that's some of the best data that's out there. It's a little surprising, and it's expensive to try to do research on populations of people who are just out there, and you know they're not part of the database, so it's hard to identify them and find this information. So, that's why we think that this focus on continuing to look at what we've got, look at what other states are doing, keep getting smarter, rather than continuing to throw expensive solutions at a problem that may or may not be effective. So that was, again, that's sort of the visual I keep in mind on this one. We know we need to chip away at this number, but how can we do it smart and cost effectively? Thank
Senator
you.
Senator Pratt, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. McCormick, absolutely agree that no verification system will be 100% accurate. What are you seeing as far as electronic verification programs in other states, the error rates or the knockout rates that you can't verify?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, in just looking at and in talking to several states, I think that they still are not really able to quantify what the problems are. That's the thing that it's really hard to get your arms around this because it doesn't appear to be totally for economic reasons, but it also doesn't appear to be people just flaunting the fact that they can get away without buying insurance. That's why I think the task force really feels that we need to have people verify and we need to follow up with ensuring that they have and they show proof of insurance at the time of registration so that they see that tangibly they do have to present something at that particular time that does show proof of insurance. That was a majority of the task force felt very strongly about that issue.
Senator Pratt, did you have a follow-up?
I did, Mr. Chair, and Ms. McCormick, it didn't really answer my question, so let me ask it a different way. And let me just throw out my bias. When we walked through Menlars as a transportation committee a couple of years ago, I think it was the feeling of a majority of the committee that we do need to get to electronic verification. We understand that you're working on a fixed set of requirements now, but the direction was we should start planning for developing the requirements for a subsequent release. When you do a verification, you're going to have some false positives and true negatives. So again, I'll ask, what percentage of verifications could you, or are other states able to? Are they at a 90% rate, 95% rate? Give me a sense of what percentage of registrations you would have to follow up with manually that an electronic verification system couldn't satisfied.
McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm looking at the map that we had, and we talked with a few states to talk about their programs, and in general, most of them are at 10% and above, and so there's not, and we are at 10.8%, but a state like Texas, which has what a lot of people consider a very good verification system, is at 13.3%. And so that's when we were talking about it, it's very difficult to get your arms around really what is going to make the difference. And that's why the task force felt very strongly that the first thing we needed to do was to make this change in at least having to verify insurance at the time of registration. So that would give us more data to see if that would help at all or what the difference is. So if you, we have a map, and I don't know if you have a copy of the PowerPoint now, but it's on page 7 that does show the uninsured motorist rate and the reporting type, program type, which shows the web services, the data.
I think that's on page 2 on our pad.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
The bottom left, is it? Okay.
You have a different version. Thank you.
You must have a different version. Okay. So this is the page that we're talking about, though. And it shows that there, it's just not one factor. I think the thing that we came, but we felt that would be a starting point. Many of the members felt very strongly about the fact that people need to be made aware and remember that there is this requirement to get insurance, and that at one place that what happens is every year when you have to renew your registration or register a new vehicle.
And, Mr. Chair, we tried to really sort of map out a correlation. A thing you can't take into consideration with that kind of analysis is time. For example, Alabama has a pretty ambitious program, but it is hot off the press. They haven't had no time to have any results. On the other hand, if you look at Texas's number, my husband and I actually lived in Texas when they first started doing the kind of verification system that we're discussing right now, and it was a big it was a big change in the system and the way they'd done things. And, over time, people realized, wait a minute, I can't just skate without making sure I have insurance on a fairly consistent basis. And now in that intervening 20 years, they've implemented a web-based program, but that's relatively new. So it's hard to do a straight correlation of if you have this type of system, you see this sort of decline in your uninsured motorist rate.
Here's what we're going to do. We thought we'd do this in about 15, 20 minutes, but this bill's sitting in transportation today.
Be heard this week.
And we're going to get another look at this later, so these have been good questions, but we will get another bite of the apple in this committee where it should be looked at even further. But Senator Kosalka, final.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Just for Ms. McCormick, maybe if you could look at some of the states that didn't have verifying systems like they do now, like Texas, and what was their rate before and what was their rate after? Because every state's going to be different. So if you can get us some of that data to see, are there improvements in state from where they were before and to where they are after?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, yes, we can put that together for the committee.
Okay, take a look at that's a good question, and you've heard some of our thoughts and concerns here, and we'll catch you at the next term. So thank you very much, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you.
Senator Kent and Senator Jensen, we'd like to, not going to rush anything, but we'd like to move your bills out of here today if possible. So first one, you want to, any order you'd like. I've got Senate File 300 on the top of the list here. Okay, we have before us Senate File 300.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Senate File 300 amends a section of law which regulates health plan policies issued as stop-loss coverage for self-insured group health plans. I do have an amendment I would like to offer the A1 to get it in the shape I would like to present it.
Can't do it.
Do you have the amendment?
Yeah, we have it. Get to look at it. It's an author's amendment, and put it in the form she'd like it in. On the amendment, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Ms. Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In a self-insured group health plan, the employer assumes the financial risk for providing health care benefits to its employees. The employers pay for each claim as they occur instead of paying premiums to an insurance carrier. The self-insured plans can be attractive, but they also include elements of risk. These insurance contracts are between the stop-loss carrier and the employer. They're not health insurance policies. There are two forms, and we address both of the forms in this particular bill. There's a specific stop-loss, which provides the employer with protection against excessive claims incurred by individuals. And the aggregate stop-loss provides the employer with protection when a high number of claims are incurred by the group as a whole for the policy year. In that particular instance, the employer pays for and is responsible for payment of all claims during that year, and then anything that goes above the excess amount will be reimbursed to the employer. The current statute makes some distinctions between small group employers at 50 or fewer and large groups at 51 or more, and what we're doing in this bill is we're removing that distinction. So if you take a look at the bill in lines 1.13, down to 1.20, you can see where subdivision 1 has the specific attachment point, which is for the individuals. We've removed section 2 for the aggregate for groups of 50 or fewer. And in essence, we're creating the aggregate attachment point to be the same for large or small groups. I do have some people with me. They can talk to the effect of these particular provisions.
Okay, you have your first Bob witness. Hamlin. Would you like to?
This is Bob Hamlin. He's the owner of Corporate Health Systems, Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, and he'll speak to some of the specifics.
Welcome to the Commerce Committee of the Senate, Mr. Hamlin. And
thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Hamlin. I've been here before. I was on the governor's Health Exchange Advisory Board, and so I'm not new to here, but thank you for letting me come here. I wanted to explain just briefly these provisions and more so ask if there's any questions and hone in on any questions that you might have. The sole purpose of trying to pass this bill is to try to even out the field for corporations who want to self-fund. Today, small companies do not have the same advantage as a bigger company. So if you're under 50 employees, the rules are a little bit different if you want to self-fund. My company has been self-funding for the companies for the last 27 years. 3 years before that, I worked for the second largest TPA in the country, and we worked for companies self-funding them. And so we understand self-funding, and we work with all size of corporations. We work with public entities and small private corporations as well. As we move into it, when you want to level off the playing field, the specific stop loss, moving it down from 20 to 6,500, if you're over 50 employees, you don't have that issue, the situation. So if you're 51 or 52 or 100 or 200 or 1,000 or whatever, an employer can pick a stop loss that's equal to whatever they feel is necessary, according to the underwriters, that meets the risk of their corporation. So when you're under 50 employees, to mandate that they must have a higher level or a certain level that's not tied to any actuary numbers based on their claims, that sets them up at a disadvantage. Same thing with the aggregate stop loss. When you have that where the aggregate stop loss is supposed to be derived at whatever your claims were for the previous year, and you run it through regular underwriting and you come up with what you think are going to be your expected claims, and then you put a margin on top of that, 10%, 15%, 20%. That's how corporations are self-funded. under the Minnesota law here, if you're under 50, they try to set it for you. So if your claims are doing really well, your liability is still higher than it needs to be. So keeping the specific stop-loss level and the aggregate stop-loss level the way it is today, you're setting up the exposure for smaller companies higher than it needs to be in many instances. So we don't feel that's fair for a smaller company. Run-out provision, the same thing is run-out, not to try to teach everybody how to be an insurance person, but run-out, you can either run it in or run it out. And so many companies look at it and say, well, we want to choose how we're going to set up our policy with the reinsurance company that we select. And so we can set up our run-in protected from the previous period, or we can set it up so we can protect it on a run-out going forward. And they get to make that choice. Here, we basically tell a small company, and we don't tell any other companies that are over 50, that your policy has to be incurred, and basically saying that any claim that's picked up under this 12-month period has to be paid no matter what. And policies just aren't sold that way in the market. And so there's not as many insurance companies that will sell in Minnesota because of that. And so it sets it up for a small company not to have very many viable reinsurance companies at their disposal. As soon as you get over 51 employees, now you have the open market. So once again, we felt that we should equalize that as well and set it up so the policy would be more standardized. In this case, we actually put in a provision that said give them 1 month of run out, whereas normal standard policy is there is no limit, there is no run out. Corporations get to choose how much liability they want to pick up. So those are the three provisions that we were suggesting that would equalize a smaller company who wants to self-fund that would be more equal to the 51-plus employee if they so choose to self-fund. I think that's the...
Taylor, any questions of Mr. Hamlin or the author?
I think there were some others that wanted to...
We have a couple of Mr. Graves and Mr. Hickey want to visit with us or not?
Mr.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm the Director of Healthcare and Transportation Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. As most of you know, we are a membership organization of about 2,300 businesses statewide, with roughly half of those representing less than 100 employees. We hear pretty constantly from our members that health insurance costs are continue to be a concern. And one of the main things that we hear from our members is an appetite for additional options. And I want to thank Senator Jensen for bringing this bill forward. I think given the description you've heard here today, this would certainly not just level the playing field, but give the opportunity for self-insuring to more businesses. And so something that we strongly support. So with that, thank you all. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, so the Chamber wholeheartedly endorses what Senator Jensen is trying to accomplish here. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that's good. Any further discussion on Senate File 300? Mr. Hickey, yes, I mentioned your name. I didn't see you walking forward, though. But
hi, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for not forgetting me. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. Minnesota, and we're the major small business group. As many of you know, we have 13,000 members across the state and really struggle with health insurance, and we've really struggled with health insurance since the enactment of the ACA and post-ACA. It's been a huge issue. I'm sure you've heard from a lot of your small business constituents and your individual constituents, too. Anyone who has to go purchase health insurance versus receiving it from an employer. We want to thank Senator Jensen for bringing this bill forward. We need to look for every tool to try to help small businesses deal with what they're dealing with right now. Less choice in health insurance, higher cost, and I'm sure you've heard many comments from your constituents about that. This bill is definitely going to make it easier for small employers to look at a self-insurance option, and it's going to make it cheaper to do that. It's not for everyone. You have to be in it for the long haul. You have to have the assets. But to also do it. But we think it, you know, the changes that were discussed here be very beneficial, and urge you to support it. I'm going to pass out a copy of our survey. We did the only survey in the Minnesota health insurance market for the open enrollment period, which ran from October 1, 2013 to March 31st, 2014. And this was through the Minnesota, through one of the agent associations here. We were able to involve 60 agents. I don't know if Senator Jensen, if you were able to give a comment. 2,454 customers and tens of thousands of insureds, and the vast majority of small businesses, not all, but you'll see in the results, got an increase, some horrendous. There were some decreases too, but notably 135% increase for some poor small business down by Rochester due to collision of whatever factors under the implementation of the ACA. The maximum decrease we could find through all this was 62%. And we'll share that with you. People are really struggling and they need the options.
Thank you for that. I think we've got the order. We can move on.
Yeah, I'd like to move Senate File 300 be recommended to pass as amended and placed on general orders.
Okay, any further discussion? Anybody in the audience wish to be heard for or against this? Seeing none, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Jensen and Mr. Hamlin and
thank
Mr.
You.
Hickey. And, the next bill, Senate File 997, Senator Jensen, long-term care insurance partnership policy. Welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Paul, you want to do this?
Senate File 997 modifies our inflation protection features of long-term care insurance partnership policies. The long-term care partnership program was designed to encourage consumers to buy private long-term care insurance. It's federally supported. It's a state-operated initiative that allows individuals who purchase a qualified long-term care insurance policy to protect a portion of their assets that they would typically need to spend down prior to qualifying for medical assistance. The benefits of long-term care are clear. It provides a way for people to take responsibility for their long-term care and not rely on the government. It can help people preserve their home, farm, and other assets for the next generation. It alleviates the need for people to burden their family members with their care. And it provides a way for people to control the care that they receive, where and how it is provided. To encourage people to purchase it, the federal government enabled the states to create these long-term care partnership programs. And but despite the benefits that you see from long-term care, the cost of the product has discouraged people from purchasing it. In a recent survey, 74% of the people surveyed cited the cost is the primary reason they haven't purchased long-term care insurance. So the goal of Senate File 997 is to make long-term care more affordable to middle-income people that need it the most. It does this by allowing partnership policies to be sold with lower levels of inflation protection. Their inflation protection riders allow the benefit to keep pace with the cost of care. Senate File 997 is supported by the Department of Commerce and was one of the recommendations of Governor Dayton's own Your Future Advisory Panel. And I have with me Robin Rowan, who would also like to talk to the bill a little bit.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. Welcome, Ms. Rowan, to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, or MFSI. MFSI members provide financial security to Minnesotans through the sale of life and long-term care insurance, annuities, 401k plans, and other retirement products. MFSI members also support 65,000 jobs in Minnesota, and that includes the agents and financial advisors that distribute our products in every corner of the state. Current law requires that in order for a policy to be partnership qualified, it has to include an inflation protection rider of 3%. And so, as Senator Jensen said, we're proposing to change the floor to 1%. It might actually be the smallest change you ever see in a bill. It's just changing the word 3 to 1, but we're hoping it has a very significant impact on the long-term care insurance market. What we discovered since the partnership program was established in 2006 is that the cost of the 3% rider is pricing middle-income people out of the market, and as Senator Jensen mentioned, those are exactly the folks that we want to buy the product. For example, if you had a 55-year-old couple purchasing a partnership policy with a 3% rider and an initial benefit pool of $185,000, the premiums would be approximately $348 a month. With the 1% inflation protection rider, the couple could save over $100 a month and over $1,400 a year. And industry research has shown that that puts it right in the wheelhouse of what people say they're willing to spend on long-term care insurance. We've also discovered that with the 3% rider, people are often paying for more coverage than they need or that they use. A recent study by Genworth, which is the nation's largest long-term care writer, showed that people are only using 67% of the benefit that they paid for. So what we have is people buying more coverage than they need, essentially. And part of the reason for this is the advent of home care. Most people prefer to have long-term care in their home and to stay in their home as long as possible. And the cost of home care is growing. Even though Minnesota has some of the highest home care costs in the country, it's still growing at less than 1%. And has been doing so for the past 5 years. So what we feel is that allowing a lower inflation protection option for people will encourage more people to purchase long-term care insurance, which is good for them, good for the state. And you could still buy, if you wanted, you could still buy 3%, you could still buy 2%, you could still buy 5%. But this would give people more flexibility and hopefully get more middle-income people into the market.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you. And Senator Jensen, or to the testifier, you had given the I couldn't remember your last name. Rowan.
Rowan. Yeah.
It's Rowan. Sorry. You'd given the example of for a policy for $185,000, people 55, a couple 55 years old, monthly premium of $348. You said if we reduce this to 1%, it could mean a savings of $100 a month in their premium. How do we know that that would happen? Is that are you projecting what standard industry pricing would be if they had that flexibility? I just would like you to expound on that some.
Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, you can 1% policies with 1% inflation protection riders are for sale now across the country, but they're not they wouldn't be partnership qualified in Minnesota. So we know what a comparison would be between a 3% inflation protection policy and a 1%.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the A1 amendment.
Senator Dames moves the A1 amendment. We'll make sure everyone has a copy of that. And if you wanted to, Senator Dames, you want to explain your amendment while it's being handed out?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Policies are issued in the long-term care partnership program after 2006 have an asset protection as part of that statute. This amendment would allow policies that have been purchased prior to 2006 at the request of the policyholder to the insurance company that's issued the policy to have that same right of asset protection. It would amount to the policyholder would have to request it from the insurance company, and then the insurance company would honor that. So it put the previous purchase policies in the same position as the ones that were purchased after 2006.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I was in the other body in 2006 when we worked on the long-term care partnership plans, and we were debating about whether we would require insurance companies to grandfather him. That would have been must language or may, and we chose may language. In other words, they could or couldn't. We didn't know how it would all turn out, but a number of policies were not grandfathered in. So some weren't arbitrary, not based on benefits, but just on a decision that the company made. And so this would take care of that so that if policies that were not grandfathered in back then, if the policyholder requested of the insured that theirs would be and it was eligible, then it would qualify.
Senator Jensen, are you aware of the amendment or just learning about it?
Mr. Chair, I have had some conversation about this particular amendment, and I'm agreeable to the language.
Any other questions about the amendment itself? So Senator Dames moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 997. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
I should ask if anyone in the audience want to comment on the amendment. I don't know. It's controversial.
Any further testifiers to the bill or the as amended at this time? Senator, any other questions from the committee members? Senator Jensen, any final words?
Not at all.
Yes, I'd like to move Senate File 997 be recommended to pass as amended and placed on general orders.
On that motion, if there's no other discussion, Senate File 997, Senator Jensen moves Senate File 997 as amended be passed and sent to general orders. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Jensen. And Senate File 1043. Feel free to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1043 allows credit unions to conduct savings promotion raffles to encourage people to save, and I do have an author's amendment, the A1.
Senator Jensen moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 1043. Looks like a technical change there.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We need to make sure absolutely clearly that this only applies to state or federally chartered credit unions and banks.
On Senator Jensen's author's amendment, the A1 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 28% of the households in the United States do not have any accounts with a financial institution, and 30% of American households do not have a savings account, according to data that was collected by the FDIC in 2011. What we're working with here are called price-linked savings. They're special savings accounts, which essentially treat every deposit as a ticket in a drawing. With every preset dollar amount deposited in a participating financial institution up to 10 in a month, the saver is entered into monthly and quarterly prize drawings. Following the passage of the Federal American Savings Promotion Act in 2014, which removed the federal barriers which prohibited banks and thrifts from offering prize-linked savings accounts, states have been passing these laws that expand opportunities for residents to save money. This bill removes the state-level barriers to banks and other financial institutions that offer these types of accounts. It's a fun way it's making saving fun.
All right.
By offering savers the chance to win prizes based on their saving activity, the more the person saves, the more chances they have to win. And I do have someone with me here to testify. Keith Malbrew. He's the CIO from Affinity Plus Federal Credit Union.
Thank you. Go ahead and just introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Keith Malbrew, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 1043. In addition to being Chief Administrative Officer and Chief Information Officer at Affinity Plus Credit Union, I'm also a board member at Doorways to Dreams Fund, or D2D, a nonprofit that works with the financial services industry, national nonprofit groups, grassroots community agencies, and public policy organizations to generate promising ideas, pilot test financial products and services, build awareness of the needs and potential of low-income communities, and advocate inclusive social and economic policies. D2D has long been a passionate advocate for price-linked savings account model. These accounts help motivate individuals to save by rewarding smart savings behavior. Price-linked savings models have been implemented internationally, and 11 states have now passed laws to allow for price-linked savings accounts and help more people save through the excitement of winning. And this past December, the U.S. Congress passed, with bipartisan support, and President Obama signed into law the American Savings Promotion Act, which promotes federal which removes federal barriers to broaden adoption of PriceLink savings products. PriceLink savings products have proven to engage financially vulnerable consumers in the act of saving and help them build their financial security. By injecting fun and the excitement of winning into the act of savings, PriceLink savings products have incentivized first-time savers, resulting in long-term savings and acquired new customers for financial service firms who offer these products. In 2009, D2D and Michigan Credit Unions created Save to Win, the first scaled PriceLink savings-based program. Save to Win offers special balance building certificates of deposits, or CDs, that enter members into raffles for cash prizes with each deposit of $25 or more. Michigan credit unions that participated in the initial pilot demonstrated that the possibility of winning both a large $100,000 annual jackpot and a range of regularly awarded smaller prizes encourages people to save. Michigan credit unions increased their engagement with financially vulnerable consumers and kept them coming back for more. The success of Save to Win Michigan inspired other states and entities to launch similar PriceLink savings programs to better serve consumers. The state of Nebraska signed on to Save to Win at the beginning of 2012 and is showing promising gains. In 2012, Save to Win Nebraska engaged 10 credit unions and opened 1,643 Save to Win accounts. These Save to Win account holders saved over $1.9 million, representing an average savings of $1,200. In 2013, North Carolina and Washington both launched Save to Win, adding 13 new credit unions with the product. PriceLink savings accounts are working. Across the states that offer them, 62 to 81% of account holders were financially vulnerable. Overall, between 81 and 85% of participants rolled over their accounts between years. In 2013, average account balances ranged from $921 to $2,662. And since the product was first offered in 2009, 50,000 account holders have collectively saved $94 million. America is facing a savings emergency. Approximately a quarter of U.S. citizens have absolutely no savings at all, and 48% would have to borrow money or sell assets to come up with $400 for a car repair or a doctor bill. With the success we've seen in other states, there's every reason to be optimistic that we can achieve the same level of attainment here in Minnesota. While PriceLink savings accounts may not totally solve the savings crisis that we find ourselves in today, they will go a long way towards helping people develop strong savings habits. As evidence, PriceLink savings accounts are a tested, successful concept in which consumers earn chances to win by saving in insured financial institutions. The accounts make savings fun, provide an incentive for people to save more, help financially vulnerable families become more financially secure, create a no-lose proposition for savers. Everyone who saves maintains their deposit, plus whatever interest they accrue, whether they win additional prizes or not. Thank you for your time and attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Malbrew. Any questions for our testifiers? Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and congratulations. I'm a member of Affinity, and I'm really happy to see you taking the lead on this issue. I talked to folks a couple years ago when I first heard about it, and so it's nice to see it finally come to fruition. I think it's a great idea.
Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Jensen, I too like this bill, and you've given me an idea for another bill, and that would be the more state legislators save in the state budgeting process, that maybe we can have some incentives for that for us to spend less money. So I think I may go to work on that. Thank you for the idea.
Mr. Chair, that would be fun.
Any other questions? If not, Senator Jensen.
I move that Senate File 1043 be recommended as amended to pass and sent to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Yes. If there's no other comments, Senator Jensen moves Senate File 1043 as amended be referred to state and local government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Senator Metzen, I understand we meet Wednesday at noon. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yes. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, members. Meeting adjourned.